Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. The world needs more women like Ann Jacobs, who has worked in the criminal justice field on the local and national levels for more than 40 years. Since 2011, she's been the director of the Prison Reentry Institute at New York City's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And boy, does she and her staff have their work cut out for them. Helping inmates navigate a changing world once they're released from prison is a never-ending and an overwhelming challenge. Ann's no stranger to the problem. Before joining PRI, she was executive director of the Women's Prison Association in New York. The WPA is the country's oldest and largest social service and advocacy organization for incarcerated women, former inmates, and their families. Under Ann's 20-year tenure, the WPA's budget grew from $500,000 in 1990 to $8.5 million in 2008. She's designed and implemented innovative programs for women and families in the criminal justice system and has served as a consultant to the National Institute of Corrections. She also founded the Women's Justice Alliance, the Institute on Women and Criminal Justice, and the Women's Advocacy Project. Her work also encompasses the juvenile justice system. Let's meet this committed, passionate woman on a mission. Ann, thanks so much for joining me today.
Good morning, Sandy. Thank you for having me.
You in criminal justice, how and why?
Well, I'd have to admit that it was almost an accident. I grew up a long time ago. I knew that I wanted to do something that made a contribution, and I had no idea what that would be. However, my sociology professor at the time also recognized that I had kind of a limited interest in what was happening in the classroom and was much more interested in what was happening on the street. It was a very active time. It was the midst of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was no shortage of...
I was going to say, had a lot to choose from.
...worthwhile things going on. And he made a placement for me in... at the time, I was at GW University in Washington, and he made a placement, an internship placement for me at a program that was funded by the Department of Labor to cut down on the number of people that were just going through the revolving door of the criminal justice system by particularly focusing on giving them employment opportunities.
So working on lowering the recidivism rate.
Right. So this was in the 60s, late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I was a college student. I was just sitting at the back of the room. You know, at that point, what we called collecting data was literally going through paper files and putting hash marks on a page. And it gave me like this window into all kinds of worlds that I knew nothing about, but that I found very interesting and engaging.
So that kind of pressed a button.
It did.
Mm-hmm.
It did. I mean, I could have gone in a lot of directions at that point because careers were such abstractions. but one internship led to another. Then I got a chance to work in the D.C. jail and the D.C. Department of Corrections, and then a halfway house that was run by the department.
All while you were still in school?
Correct. And then I discovered, you know, what the limitations were of halfway houses run by the system, and I went to work in Baltimore at a halfway house run by formerly incarcerated people and discovered what the limitations were there, too. All the time going to school.
And so this was clearly having an impact on you.
It was. It was very engaging, very exciting. It felt like the place that I was learning the most.
Now, did that have an impact on your decision to go to law school? And did you go to law school right after getting out of undergraduate school?
No, I didn't go right away. I had the good fortune, because I started in these internships, of meeting people who were doing really exciting work and of one opportunity after another being available to me, both in Washington and then I moved to Baltimore. I finished school at night. It took me 5 years to get my undergraduate degree, but was still doing really interesting work in Baltimore with juveniles as alternatives to incarceration for juveniles. And I went to law school after being out for about 3 years, but not with, I think, a real appreciation of what that would give me. I went because at that point, there weren't a lot of graduate degrees that were very attractive to me, and it was still unusual for women to go to law school. But I'm a law school dropout. I didn't finish.
Okay.
I got to the point where I had to make a choice between the classes and traveling for work. And, you know, as was my default, I kept choosing the work. But I benefited a lot from the time I was
there. Well, clearly the experience
had the most impact, just like it did for you in undergraduate school. You're out there in the trenches as opposed to sitting in a classroom attending a lecture.
Exactly right.
Don't apologize for not having a law degree.
Well, I learned a lot about legal research and writing that's benefited me my whole career, I think. And it's only now that I'm like at the end of, something that I'm going, well, maybe I could have done that too. Maybe it wasn't, didn't have to be a choice, but.
So go back now.
I could do that. But work still is pretty engaging.
So lead us on to the trajectory of doing what you did in Baltimore and winding up getting very involved in the country's prison system.
I think that there are kind of three parallel tracks that, were at play in the evolution of my life and my work. One was trying to discover what was going on in criminal justice. How was it that so many people were being pulled into the system? My career paralleled this gigantic increase in the number of people and the rate of incarceration to the point that America incarcerates more people, a larger part of its population than any other country
in the world. And that's still true today.
Yes. And that's how you would characterize the last 40 years of what's happened in our criminal justice system. So trying
to— Or what hasn't happened.
Right. It's both, right? And trying to understand that. And I had the good fortune from those early days to know people who had been through the criminal justice system. So I wasn't just learning about it from books or from the perspective of people who ran the system, but I was also learning about it from the perspective of people who had been locked up and who now were trying to contribute to reform. So my work was very focused on criminal justice reform. At the same time, I was like really interested in what does it take for organizations to work. I had the opportunity to work in a number of not-for-profits at the local level and the national level. I got to work in the mayor's office in New York City and then to run my own not-for-profit. And across the board, these are organizations that are filled with really smart, well-intentioned, hardworking people who often are used up by the work that they're doing rather than nurtured by it, dissatisfied by the results that they're able to produce.
Feel like they're just running in place.
Or losing ground. I mean,
it isn't as
satisfying or rewarding. It doesn't make the differences that you think it's going to make. So that sort of what does it take for organizations to make a difference was an interest of mine. At the same time, I was trying as an individual, as a person, to figure out, what the secrets of the universe were. So there was a real parallel process going on, between my personal journey, my professional journey, and these like different aspects of work that I got to take on.
What was it that really spoke to you? That you wanted, in spite of all the obstacles, we're going to try really hard to affect change?
Oh, it was never a question. I mean, it was just obvious. I think that if I had to figure out what was always motivating me or driving me, it was to be of use.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Marge Piercy poem that mm-hmm. I particularly like, but it's to be of use. And the particular talents that I've got are to see a gap where there is some possibility that if somebody stepped into it and provided some leadership and brought people together, there would be, some other set of possibilities that could be created.
And that's
here.
What you've done.
That's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am not an original thinker. I am not a theoretician.
Mm-hmm.
I am much more practical than that.
Well, that's what we need, don't we?
I think we need it all. But this is the role that I'm talented at playing.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one that I like.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm good at.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Ann Jacobs, who is the director of the Prison Reentry Institute at New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. So what came first, the Women's Justice Alliance or the WPA, the Women's Prison Association?
Oh, yes. Well, the Women's Prison Association is a fascinating organization. It was started in the 1860s by Quakers.
Did it start in New York?
Yes. Okay. It was a spinoff of what we now know as the Correctional Association.
Wow.
Which is also a remarkable organization that has watchdog status in our prisons. It's legislatively mandated to be able to enter our prisons and observe conditions. But there were some women on the board of what that, at that point, the Correctional Association was known as the Prison Association. And there were some women on the board, and they couldn't keep themselves from wanting to, like, get their hands in the mud and actually deliver direct services. So they bought a townhouse and set up the first halfway house for women in the country.
In New York?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, it was inhabited primarily by immigrant women who had alcohol problems or economic and alcohol problems.
And this is back in the late 1800s?
Yes.
Wow, that was pretty revolutionary.
It was very revolutionary. And the organization continues to operate to this day. I was lucky enough to be hired as its executive director in 1990, and it was at a time that it was not funded to do very much and was actively considering whether, in fact, it continued to have relevance and a mission. In fact, it was an incredibly important organization because what we were learning was that women were the fastest growing segment of this growing incarcerated population.
Why?
Because of our incredible punitiveness about drugs, because of the war on drugs, because of the way that the war on drugs was administered. It was supposedly supposed to take the kingpins, but much more frequently it took the kind of casual participants, including in the federal system, women who just took messages for their boyfriends who were the real drug.
And nothing's changed much.
No. Well, some things have changed in as much as there is some sort of significant reconsideration going on nationally and locally about whether this is, in fact, the best approach. I think there's an agreement developing between the right and the left that, in fact, we incarcerate too many people for too long a period of time, that it doesn't produce a good result. But there's still a lot of damages. You know, there's still a lot of people who are locked up.
Sure.
And our punitiveness didn't stop with locking them up. It continued into what we call collateral consequences, which were laws that were developed that meant that if you had a criminal conviction, you were also precluded from lots of other things, including for a while in New York, having a barber's license or being a cosmetician or certain kinds of housing or certain kinds of financial benefits. I mean, as recently as the last congressional reauthorization of food stamps, they wanted to preclude people from eligibility if they'd had a criminal conviction.
It's just nuts.
It is. It's as if any criminal conviction is a life sentence. It's as if not only are we giving up on people, we are making it almost impossible for them to succeed.
And we're just pouring good money after bad for nothing.
Yes, and doing an enormous amount of damage
at the same time
to people, to their families, and to communities. There are communities that are disproportionately affected by this. There used to be this phrase called a million-dollar block. There are literally blocks in New York City where the number of people who are incarcerated at any one time from that block exceeds $1 million a year of incarceration
costs. That's just insane.
We could do a lot better with that money.
You think?
Parks, recreation, schools, childcare.
So you're working really hard and you're doing all this really hard work. And then I read that you go to Costa Rica from 2008 to 2011 to live on an organic farm in the mountains.
I did.
It just begs the question, burnout?
I think the answer is probably yes, but it was also a very kind of positively inclined move to do something very different for my family. My whole family went, including my sister and brother-in-law, and we built this kind of Walton-like, you know, farm that we all lived on. And it was kind of a remarkable, completely unexpected experience.
That is the most fascinating thing I have ever heard. How many people did this involve?
About 10.
10 of you decide to live communally, even though you're all related to each other, and you're all in agreement that you're going to farm.
Give up our lives here and go try that.
And farm organically in Costa Rica.
Right.
And you stayed for 3 years.
Yeah, actually, we had the farm for about 7, but I came back here because I was ready to get back to work.
Because you were craving What, bacon?
I learned to make bacon on the farm. We raised our own food, including pigs, and I learned to make
something.
Bacon.
I was going to say, you just couldn't wait to have something processed. What was that like?
The whole experience was incredible. It was really remarkable. We didn't go to a touristy area to live. We lived in the mountains, in the rainforest, you know, in an area that was inhabited basically by five other families that had all kind of married each other. And it was incredibly beautiful and calming. I mean, my daily meditation was hanging the wash with the monkeys and the iguanas in the trees above me.
Wow.
Unbelievable. I got to have one of my fantasies. I had a pack of dogs. I had six dogs at one time, which was incredible.
Okay.
Not your thing, I can tell.
No, not even one dog. And you and your relatives lived communally and happily.
Mm-hmm. Very
productively
happily.
And peacefully.
And we tried a lot of things and decided that economically we were not going to be able to recreate or reimagine ourselves there. I never got very good at Spanish. I got good enough to run errands, but it wasn't good enough to have, like, new friends. I got a little lonely. I did. I loved the family, but I wanted more.
Did you sell your produce?
Sometimes, yeah. We were part of a collective with some local growers of papaya, and we sold that.
But that's not what kept you going. It was the money that you all...
That took down there.
Yes.
The money we took down there.
And so then you have this amazing experience, and you say... It's time for me to go back because I've had enough.
Because I miss, you know, the work. I mm-hmm. miss people who do the work. We also had adopted kids, and they were school age, mm-hmm. and they'd made a valiant effort to succeed in Spanish-speaking schools. However, they had some special needs that were going to get better met here. So we just decided it was time to come back.
Does the farm still exist?
It does. I think it's a yoga retreat now.
So your family has nothing to do with it anymore.
No, we sold.
All right. It's 2011. You come back. And does John Jay College of Criminal Justice come to your door?
Well, I was very lucky that the president of John Jay College, Jeremy Travis, who's a remarkable man and a remarkable contributor to criminal justice reform, I've known him literally for decades, mm-hmm. did have an opening for something for which I was a good candidate, and he offered me the job.
Did the Prison Reentry Institute exist?
It did. It had been founded when he came to the college in 2005. And created by a remarkable woman, Debbie Muckamal, who's now at Stanford. And it had done really good work, so it was a great place to step into. It was a little, you know, given what I've told you about my own kind of skitsiness about academics, mm-hmm. and it was kind of unexpected for me that I'd end up at a college.
Academia, yeah.
I felt like I had to keep warning the president. You know, I'm not exactly an academic or a researcher.
But your experience speaks for itself. Who cares?
He knew what he was getting,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, what's the point? So talk to me about PRI.
PRI is this remarkable place because we do have access to this incredibly robust college, you know, filled with students, both undergraduate and graduate students, and faculty.
You're not an English major if you're going to John Jay College. You're studying criminal justice.
Well, actually, you could be an English major.
Oh,
now.
I can't believe you said that to me.
You could be. That was one of the things that marked President Travis's leadership. They spun off the community college component of John Jay to the community colleges that now run justice academies, where people who want to study criminal justice can start and then transfer to John Jay. But they also took the liberal arts and, with a justice theme, increased the academic focus
actually,
in English
and
history and, mm-hmm. and those areas, and you can major in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I personally have found that when I hire staff that have that kind of creative background, but a social justice kind of passion, you get the best of both worlds.
I can see that.
And I think that's true for the college, too.
So you get the job. You come in, and what do you do? What do they want?
Well, they want something that is going to bridge the experience of academia with what I keep calling the real world,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of my orientation anyway. And beyond that, you're supposed to do good work that you can get funded. And so I inherited some wonderful programs like the New York City Justice Corps that focuses on 18 to 24-year-olds that are coming back to their community and who can be seen as a burden or a problem, but they also have this incredible potential to contribute. And the Justice Corps invites them into learning about their communities through a new perspective, developing community benefits projects that they do for the community, and which gives the community a chance to see them differently. And so the New York City Justice Corps is a wonderful program that continues to be funded by the City of New York through the Center for Economic Opportunity. We also have a very significant focus on higher education as a reentry strategy for people who are coming out of prison and jail. Education has always been kind of neglected. When you think about people coming out of prison and jail, you think about drug treatment or jobs or housing.
Right.
All of which are really big, significant challenges that need to be addressed. But you also should be speaking to the possibility, to the potential that people have to change the trajectory of their life really dramatically.
Absolutely.
And we know that college in prison has an incredible effect on reducing recidivism and increasing employability. It's transformational. It changes who people think they are, how they understand the world, and how they want to show up. So we run a college program at Otisville State Correctional
Which
facility.
Is in upstate New York.
It mm-hmm. is. It's in Orange County. And we do a lot of work in other facilities to introduce college as a possibility to both the inmates and staff who operate under certain myths, like people with criminal records can't go to college.
Mm-hmm.
They can.
Mm-hmm.
They can go to college.
Mm-hmm.
They can get financial aid when they're out. And right now, the Department of Education, the U.S. Department of Education, has announced that it's going to do a second chance Pell pilot, which will give certain jurisdictions the ability to offer Pell grants again to people who are locked up, which should allow for an expansion of people who can get college while they're locked up and come out in tangibly better shape to have a different kind of life.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Ann Jacobs, who happens to be the director of the Prison Reentry Institute at New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. So it's 2015. How different are things since 1860?
I think that whether it's 1860 or, 2015, there are really important things happening that warrant our attention and our reflection and our action. So we then and now should be concerned about economic inequity and poverty,
mm-hmm.
about what is happening to our children in terms of having hungry children and kids that aren't getting education and kids whose families can't provide them with the kind of stability that they need because they're dealing with their own economic challenges. I think all of these are problems that should concern us and that exist now as well as then. Those of us who work in criminal justice are really enjoying that we're getting more attention to our issues right now, and some things seem possible that didn't seem possible 5 years ago.
So there's an excitement.
There is.
And an optimism.
That there may be some opening for sentencing reform.
Are you very involved in advocacy?
Yes. I think that, everybody needs to be involved in advocacy. I personally have learned that I am the most satisfied when my work allows me to have direct contact, with real people. So I know the students in our college program mm-hmm. and teach a workshop in mm-hmm. the prison. And I know the students in our fellowship program. But I also get a chance to work with city, state, and federal officials that are trying to redesign systems. And with, my colleagues in the advocacy world that are pushing them to do it.
Share your views about the difference between the genders.
I'm smiling because I think the answer is both yes and no. Yes, we need to pay attention to gender. Women are not just, guys in skirts, right? I mean, the prison system and criminal justice is extremely hostile toward women and abusive toward women, has been historically. And so I advocated, on behalf of women for about 17 years, and now I'm back to being responsible for the whole system in my thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned is that some of the things that were big ahas about women, like how relationship-oriented they were, how a lot of the pathways to criminal justice involvement for them had to do with who they were connected to, right? And how much trauma was in their life. And that how much that had to do with their using drugs and alcohol to self-medicate. That those things are also true for men. You know, it is astounding how much trauma you will find if you ask somebody who's in prison to tell you the story of their life, how much exposure to violence, the things they've seen. The scale that's supposed to measure these kinds of things, I think it's called the Adverse Childhood Experience Scale, doesn't even get to measuring the kind of observations and exposure to violence that that kids live in the inner city have common kind of exposure to. So I think that in some ways the system would be much more responsive to human beings if it took what it's learned about women and applied it more generally. So it doesn't mean that it's okay to keep doing what we've always done for men. What we're doing for them doesn't benefit them either.
Right. Everyone's at a loss. You know, I guess I would be sort of remiss if I didn't ask you, what did you think of Orange is the New Black?
Well, I think a lot of Piper Kerman and appreciate enormously that she wrote about this and has gotten the attention to it.
Well, that sort of was my point, that whatever it takes, right?
I think that's incredibly important, and I think that, you know, a lot of kind of thinking and good things have flowed from the show. I don't think that what we see about this correctional facility is characteristic of most correctional facilities. It's a much nicer place. And for as dumb or abusive as individual staff might seem in that setting, institutionally, jails and prisons are just much more hostile places, even if the individual staff and officers are not. And I think a great deal of the people who choose to do that work. And I think that they're underappreciated and traumatized and under a great deal of stress that needs attention, too. But I think it would be wrong for people to kind of generalize that somehow prisons are like you'd see in Orange is the New Black.
They're but people could also come back and say, you know, these are not supposed to be country clubs.
Well, they're not.
Clearly.
I think you can be pretty confident that prisons and jails are
You're not supposed to really suffer.
What I think you do see from Orange is the New Black is the kind of remarkable connection among the women. And, I mean, sometimes it's used for bad, mm-hmm. but a lot of times it's used for good. And that's consistent with my experience of the kind of communities that women build for themselves. Bedford Hills was a remarkable facility.
That's a correctional facility for women.
For women. And
in Westchester
for a number
County.
Of years, it was under the direction of Elaine Lord. And as a superintendent, she took a lot of risks in allowing inmates to do meaningful work. They did research and they created programs to deal with being absentee parents and learning their rights and responsibilities, to learn about HIV and AIDS and care for inmates that were sick, but also do education for people. These were meaningful pieces of work. Mm. They also brought college back to prison before a lot of other places had figured out how to do that after Pell and Tap were eliminated. And she allowed that. And I think that we saw prison in that case be the very best experience that it can be for people. And you saw the women who came out having had those experiences be ready to fly. I mean, they're all over the city in doing meaningful work in not-for-profit and health settings.
I can't let you leave without my asking you the obvious. Are you optimistic?
I am. I'm always optimistic. I think that you can't underestimate the resiliency of people and the inclination that we have to do good and to want to contribute and to make a difference. I think that, you know, I'm concerned about what I see as kind of sweeping mindlessness and easy answers and just a remarkable lack of compassion. So I worry about that, but I think that we see incredible leadership in young people. The Black Lives Matter movement is really inspiring to me. And I think that, you know, we should, it's a choice. You get to choose whether you're going to be optimistic or pessimistic. And I think better comes out of being optimistic.
I said it in the introduction, and I'm saying it again because it's so true. We need more Ann Jacobs. It has been my pleasure and honor to get to know you. And I can't thank you enough for coming and having a conversation with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.